This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, we'll discuss the 2016 Kentucky General Assembly and look at other stories that are having an impact this week. Starting us off, Cincinnati's Parks Department is under scrutiny following revelations about how it managed the construction of Smale Riverfront Park. And joining me now to explain the story is investigative reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, James Pilcher. We invited the Parks Department to have someone join us this afternoon, but they declined. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. James, good to see you this afternoon.
Glad to be back, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Hey, give me the background on this story. Why is the construction of Smale Riverfront Park, why is that coming under scrutiny?
Well, because they used existing contracts to funnel $40 million of publicly funded work through existing contracts, and therefore none of that work was publicly bid, creating a possibility of taxpayers paying more than would have been competitively bid. The other issue that this created was that these contracts were only for a certain amount, $500,000 a piece or so, and yet tens of millions of dollars was being done, and it wasn't insured properly. So if there was anything going wrong, if the construction was shoddy, if somebody got hurt or killed on the job or whatever, the city would have been liable for anything above those insurance bonds. That's at least what we know now. There is some question as to whether or not that process violated or broke state laws that require new contracting for any public contract over $50,000. So, the park got built. It's a beautiful park, but there are still major questions, and even city officials have come out and said this is not the way it should have been done.
And just to be clear, James, no one has claimed any of the contractors did defective or poor work at this point, right?
Not at this point, no. Like I said, it's a beautiful park. They did also sink $43 million of private money and built the carousel pavilion and the Anderson Pavilion there, mostly with private money. Which led to a whole other set of questions. But nobody's saying anything went wrong. Nobody's questioning the quality of the park itself. It's just that this was called a pretty extreme example of skirting public bidding and public contracting laws.
And what's been the response from the city's Parks Department? I think that they're saying, now, wait a minute. We did everything by the letter. We were operating under what's called a master service agreement with these contracts.
Well, these master service agreements were initially created for routine repair, maintenance, and upkeep of everything from landscaping. There were 12 different ones they used. They were used for construction, electrical work, road work, landscaping, those kinds of things. And each of those contracts ran anywhere from $50,000 to $500,000. And that's what they were worth, and that's what they were insured for. They were not intended, according to the city, they were not intended to handle new work, work that was not required or not under the original contract. Those original contracts, yes, were publicly bid. And they were renewed a couple of times, and they were publicly bid then. But at no point in those contracts did anything say, well, we're going to also do tens of millions of new construction on a park. So that becomes the crux of the issue here. And the other thing that the Parks Department has been saying is that, well, this was common practice, that this was what – they just changed the rules on us recently, and this was common practice. Our reporting shows that as recently as 2012, there were city officials saying, no, you can't use this contract this way. You need to bid this out. The other thing that we've heard back from them is that, well, we would never do this again, but we were under the gun to get it done for the All-Star Game, which they did. And, you know, the chairman of the park board, which oversees the Parks Department, has even said, if we didn't do it this way, we'd have a big mud hole when the national attention came to us for the All-Star Game. But these contracts were started to being used back in the early 2000s, well before even Bob Castellini bought the team, much less before the time they tried to get the All-Star Game. So they've been using these contracts for 15 years to build this park.
So the park board, the governing body for the Parks Department. Mm-hmm. Now, what has been their response to this?
Well, they've backed to a certain extent what the Parks Department response has been. Otto Budig, the chairman.
And I should point out, too, in the interest of disclosure, that Otto Budig is also a member of the Cincinnati Public Radio Board of Directors.
No problem. I've had several conversations with him, and he stands by his assertion that they needed to get it done for the All-Star Game. But he has said maybe we should have paid closer attention. They were taking a 30,000-foot view, and they were trusting their administrators, and they weren't going to get into the weeds of public contracting law. And maybe he says maybe we should have a little bit more. On the converse side, the city administration, including Mayor John Cranley and City Manager Harry Black, have come out strongly and said this should not have been done. Cranley said it's wrong. Mayor Black said this was that this completely circumvented existing rules and laws.
And just to clarify too, James, who does the Parks Department answer to? Is it the board or is it the city administration?
It is the board, but they have to follow city rules. The board is appointed by the mayor. And then the board has hiring and firing and fiduciary responsibility over the park department. That's a rule that's been set up in the state constitution, and it's in the city charter. It's kind of a fluky thing that's unusual to a state like Ohio. Recreation departments can be set up that way too. So there is this feeling that the park board can operate independently and separately. And I'm using the words park board and parks department interchangeably here, that they can operate a little independently from the city, but yet they get city council money. They go to city council and say, we need this much for our budget. So they do get taxpayer public money. And so there's this little bit of tension there that says, well, you're on your own, but you still are using public money. You're still a public agency, and you should still follow the city rules.
So at this point, Otto Budig has said, we're stopping work on, I think it's the Serpentine Wall.
Yeah, they're refinishing the Serpentine Wall for about $1 million. And I know there's a pressure to get that done because we've got major festivals, including like the Bunbury Music Festival in June. Those kinds of things are coming, and they want to have it done for there. But he said, we're stopping that to make sure that financing was done properly.
So he wants to make sure things being done properly.
Exactly.
Now, city administration, city council itself, what are you hearing from city council members about this?
Well, it's kind of split. Some didn't respond to us. Charlie Winburn, who oversees the Finance and Budget Committee, said it's a pretty concerning thing. None of them knew. None of them expressed that they knew whether or not no-bid contracts were used for this construction, and they all acknowledged that that could be a problem. But we haven't heard from all the city councilmen. So I know Kevin Flynn has been outspoken because he's been really pushing hard to rebuild the audit division and the audit function of the city as an independent so they can kind of keep watch on projects and situations like this. So he's just using this as saying this is another example of, you know, it shouldn't take the inquirer or the procurement department having to go back and look through contracts in their systems or us doing open records requests to find this stuff.
And Tom, are council members also concerned that this might be going on in other areas, other departments?
Well, we've already proven at the inquirer that it has. My colleagues, Dan Horn and Sherry Coolidge, have done an amazing job of outlining the use of these kind of master service agreements for tens and hundreds of million dollars worth of work that may be very questionable at the Metropolitan Sewer District, which is a city department. The city runs the county's sewer system, and they use these master service agreements to funnel in accounting and different expenses like that, and hiring consultants that may or may not have been needed. So that's, and there was a memo that they even found that said pretty much you can do this by the previous city manager.
Now, the paper's been looking into this for quite a while. What prompted them to even look into this in the first place?
Well, we started looking. Obviously, the first thing that really raised our attention was last fall when we found out that the park board had donated $200,000 to the levy campaign, if you remember. The Mayor Cranley actually put forth or was really pushing for a permanent property tax levy to raise money for the parks because of their crumbling infrastructure and the like. So we found out about that $200,000 donation to the actual political campaign, which is illegal under state campaign finance rules. A public agency can't donate. So they were required or agreed to give that money back, and that kind of raised our eyebrows and said, what else is going on? So at that point, we found out, we'd already reported on previous bonuses. We found out about more bonuses. We found out about car allowances and different things being paid for by either public or private money for the top executives at the park board. And I guess the biggest question then became for us is like, well, this Parks Foundation exists and they've got tens of millions in assets, and yet they're asking the public for more money. So what gives here? So we started to really start to dig in on that relationship between the private entity and the public agency. And we were coming at it that way, and we were almost ready to publish. And then the City Hall folks told us, well, we've been coming at it from the other way, and we found that not only did they not bid out the contracts for using the private money, they didn't do it for the public money either. And at that point, that's what you saw last week.
Yeah, you talk about that a little bit more about the Parks Foundation, because that's one of the really interesting questions that you're raising. This whole thing is the issues about public and private money.
Right, right. And actually, what you saw last week was only one part of a three-part series. We're going to publish part two and part three on Sunday and Monday on Cincinnati.com and in the Inquirer. And part two will really delve into that relationship between the public agency and the private nonprofit. And what we found was these nonprofits are very much legitimate, and a nonprofit foundation to help a public agency is a very much a legitimate thing. They're common all over the country. But the way they were doing it here, they were commingling money. They were sending money back and forth, sometimes for personal expenses by the executives. The two top executives had fiduciary control, it appears, over the private money. So there was really no Chinese wall, if you will, between the two that really needs to exist under state and federal tax laws. So there's a lot of questions over that. And then, you know, just as an ancillary thing, we found that the top two executives had their own credit cards for the public credit cards outside the city system under the park board, and they were using it to charge up tens of thousands of dollars in travel and dining and personal expenses that were originally paid for out of public monies. But then they went back to the private foundation and said, well, we shouldn't have paid for it. You can pay for it. And there was no oversight. There was no checks and balances. We're talking $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 worth of stuff.
Yeah, so that's the real issue is accountability.
Exactly.
That. And private money doesn't have the same level of accountability as the public.
We even found emails from the current Parks Foundation chairman, who was treasurer at the time, even saying, I haven't been that attentive of a treasurer. It really seems like these boards are like I said, taking a 30,000-foot view and really not being attentive or providing any checks and balances to this.
But wouldn't one of the arguments that they might lay out, James, wouldn't it be, well, it worked. Mm-hmm. The public and the private partnership that we had going here, that use of those two sources of money, it worked. Look how well Smale Park turned out.
And nobody's arguing that, unlike the MSD situation, whereas the sewer system still hasn't been fixed and rates are going up. And yes, that's a valid argument. The issue becomes, well, what happens if there's problems with the construction of some of that park? Who do you go to? These contracts are so non-transparent and not insured. What happens over the long run? What's the city's liability here? Those are the major outstanding questions to this. And yeah, and it's more of an ends, does the ends justify the means kind of argument. And there are some people who've come out publicly and said yes. But in the end, it's the city that's on the hook for this. So, you know, and not only that, but did the taxpayers get the best deal they could?
Now, both MSD, now the park situation, those had their origins under old administrations. Mm-hmm. Is there any recourse to make former city officials answerable for these things?
I don't know. That's something we're certainly going to explore. Whether or not that you know, this goes back even to, at least in the park situation, back to administrations before that. Like I said, we found documents that showed these master service agreements were being used to start Smale's design and clearance work as early as 2001, 2002. So, you know, how far back do you want to go? It's more of a situation of how you fix it now.
513-419-7100 to join us. And let's talk with Kyle in Westchester. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
I had a question for the Cincinnati Inquirer, investigator there. I was wondering, with this mistake going on with the contracts and everything, who is being victimized, and to what extent is the mistake? What extent are people being victimized? And I'll take my answer off there.
Okay, thank you, Kyle.
I think the I think the biggest quote-unquote victim here, there are a couple, actually. One would be the contracting firms that didn't get a chance at this. There might have been better qualified, cheaper contractors who may have gotten in line to do some of this work. And I think the second real victim potentially here is the taxpayer. Otto Budig even told me, you know, maybe there's no way to prove it, but maybe we did pay $10, $20, $30 million more than we should have because we didn't bid it out. Well, is that $10, $20, $30 million something that the public is willing to accept in exchange for finishing 6 to 8, 12 months early? I think those would be the biggest. I think those would be the two biggest that I would think of.
Yeah. Is this way of doing business more common than it should be in cities across the country? Do you know of any similar cases?
Well, I know that it's been very pervasive. I'll only stick to Cincinnati here. I know it's been pretty pervasive. And I do know through talking through people who do investigate this stuff for a living that they do look for loopholes and things like that, and that they like to let everybody else know, hey, we found this in Cincinnati, we might find this in Cleveland or whatever. I've not heard any specifics on other cities. I did talk to a national expert about procurement who said that certainly public officials who want to get stuff done fast bristle at these rules. But these rules are put in place not only to protect the taxpayer, but protect them from staying out of the newspaper for bad reasons, if nothing else. I mean, like I said, we're talking, I don't know about criminal charges, but we're talking about potential law violations here. So, you know, do you really want that on your resume or on your legacy?
In terms of auditing, I mean, what other audits or investigations are going on this?
Actually, right after we disclosed the car allowances and all the questionable spending before the election, Mayor Cranley and City Manager Harry Black ordered a full top-to-bottom external – they call it an audit, but it's more like a forensic investigation into all of the park spending, all the park's practices, and even its relationship with the foundation. And even when I you'll read it in Monday's story, I even was the one that told them, hey, they got these credit cards outside your system. Did you know about that? And they really didn't. So things like that. That is underway. It started in December, and it is expected to be due back in May. We'll find out what comes out of that. In the meantime, the city is also in the midst of its budgeting cycle. And so the parks officials are having to go in front of city council on Monday and ask, they're asking for $4 million, and that's been cut down to about $1.5 million of extra money to help fix the stuff that didn't get paid for by the failed levy last fall. So those are some of the next steps in all of this.
Let's talk with Melvin in Milford. Hi, Melvin. Go right ahead.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I just wanted to ask, because I'm a little unclear on the language, when you say that there was kind of a skirting of the bidding process, would that mean, or is that to infer, that there are minority businesses that were not allowed to bid on the contract?
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. That is actually one of the major concerns with all of this, is that there's no documentation or accountability as to whether or not this new construction met city's minority and prevailing wage hiring rules. You know, we asked for that documentation. It was never provided. All Mr. Cardin told us was he saw the contract, signed off on it. The other guy signed off on it, and they kind of took the contractor's word for it. So no, and like I said, when they never put any of this new work out to bid, and the companies underneath the master service agreements, they made about $16 million themselves, but they subcontracted with companies, and we got a list of all the subcontractors, but we don't know which ones were minority. We don't know if those MSA, the companies originally met the minority contracting rules when they hired their subcontractors when they did this new work for SMAIL. There's no way to document that or tell that.
James, is there any talk of penalizing the contractors who did the work?
No, not yet. I don't think that anybody is looking at the contractors necessarily as the bad guys here, although I'm sure that they didn't mind getting millions and tens of millions of new work without any without having to bid for it. But I think that one of the key things that we found is that they did rebid this master service agreement, especially with the main contracting firm, construction firm Universal. They did rebid it three times, but at no point during that rebidding process did they ever say, well, as part of this contract, you're going to do SMAIL. So they knew when they bid $500,000 that perhaps they were also getting another $6 to $10 million under the table, if you will, in this new work.
But at this point, we've got some things that are going to happen surrounding this. The city's already taking steps to correct this.
And I can't say that the state auditor has previously weighed in on some of this, including how they handled open records rules and things like that. I don't know what his next step might be. They are in the process. They're not commenting on this because they are in the process of doing their annual review of Cincinnati as it is. So who knows if they want to take a closer look at this. I do know that there's potential political fallout from this. I mean, the people on the Parks Board and the Parks Foundation Board are very, very politically connected. It is the creme de la creme of business, philanthropy, and activist, if you look at it. And we're going to publish a full list of everybody on Sunday online. So you'll see everybody. I mean, we're talking like major, major well-known families all over the city.
Well, James, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
No pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Investigative reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, James Pilcher. And you can read his story on Smale Riverfront Park at Cincinnati.com. Coming up, we'll have a look at what the Kentucky General Assembly has accomplished as it wraps up its 2016 session. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Kentucky lawmakers have been dealing with some big issues, including a tight budget, since the 2016 General Assembly convened in January. The legislative body is close to wrapping up its session for this year, and joining us with a look at what the Kentucky General Assembly has accomplished, Cincinnati and Kentucky Inquirer River Cities reporter Scott Wortman and Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Scott and Ryland, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Howdy, thanks.
Scott, for those who might not be familiar with it, give us a little background and explanation of what the Kentucky General Assembly is and what it's doing.
Well, it's Kentucky's state legislature, but the interesting thing about Kentucky's legislature, it's part-time. So you have people that have full-time jobs that are going down there serving as senators and state representatives. And it does make it kind of interesting during election time. I've always found one of the key defining characteristics of Kentucky politics, you have to find people that are willing to run, that have the time to run, as well as be able to hold their jobs back in their districts.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And thanks to Jenny Jackson for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. My guests, Cincinnati and Kentucky Inquirer River Cities reporter Scott Wortman and Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. Ryland, the sessions, too, for the General Assembly, they're pretty short and sweet, aren't they? I think the law says even-numbered years, they can only go 60 days or something like that. And then in odd-numbered years, it's 30 days.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's 60 working days. So really, effectively, it lasts from early January until mid-April. So we are coming up on about 2-3 weeks until we'll be done with this thing.
And that is initially why the Kentucky went with that type of legislature, was the theory being you have less laws and less government if it's a shorter session.
And I mean, I don't know. I wonder how effective that really is in terms of how less laws and less government. I mean, there's just a ton of bills that get proposed even during these long years in which most of the attention is supposed to be focused on the budget. Really, three quarters of this legislative session was so focused on trying to pass all these bills, and the budget hasn't. People didn't get around to the budget until, I think the first version of it was passed 2 weeks ago. They're late coming to it.
Most of the significant legislation gets passed in the final half hour anyways, it seems like.
And I think the other argument you would make for this is what Scott was pointing to earlier, that these are part-time lawmakers. So it's more the idea of you have the citizen lawmaker as opposed to the professional, this is his career lawmaker. I guess that might be part of the thinking too.
Which also, in theory, it seems like it would work, but in practice, I mean, most of the lawmakers down there, I mean, this is their main focus, and this is, you know, their main passion is being, you know, in Frankfurt and in the legislature.
Outside of the regular session, they meet pretty regularly just for interim sessions and various other duties. Not to mention this year, an election year, a whole bunch of them are campaigning as well.
Mm-hmm. And Ryland, you were saying the budget's the big issue that they're working on. Where exactly do things stand with the budget?
Well, everybody has submitted their versions of the budget now. The Senate just passed their version a couple days ago. Before that, it was the House, and the first version, of course, is the governor's. Governor Bevin presented his proposal in January. So they've got as we speak, meeting in a conference committee trying to hammer out the differences between the House version and the Senate version of the budget. The House is led by Democrats, and the Senate is led by Republicans, and they have they agree on a lot of things. But there are, of course, some sticking points. The Senate's version is much more aligned with Governor Bevin's proposal for the budget. The big theme this year is he's proposing 9% cuts over the next two fiscal years, and actually 4.5% cuts for the rest of this fiscal year, which ends on June 30th.
So how much money are we talking total, Ryland, and is it a big bump from last year?
How much in cuts?
The total size of the budget.
The total size of the budget is per year a little over $10 billion. Governor Bevin has proposed cutting about $650 million a year in spending, and a lot of these cuts are really geared towards trying to shore up our pension systems, which are really ailing. One of the pension systems, which is for most state employees, is only 17% funded, which many people think is the worst publicly funded pension system in the country. And then there's the other one for teachers. The teacher retirement system is only 45% funded, so it only has 45% of the money it needs to make future payouts to retirees. And the thing is because these are so unfunded, the legislature is having to put more and more money into these systems, especially that teacher pension system. This year, the proposal is hovering between like $300 million a year and $500 million a year. So over the course of this two-year biennium, about $1 billion to just the teacher pension system. So it's this growing obligation for the state to fund.
And it pretty much affects then every other aspect of what people see from government. I mean, the judicial system, the Supreme Court Chief Justice was warning that this could mean the budget cuts that are proposed could mean 600 judicial court employees lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Scott, go ahead. Ryan, you were going to add on something there?
That's been an interesting storyline in this. The Chief Justice, who's essentially the head of the judicial branch, they actually have a whole separate budget, although it still has to be written and approved by the legislature and the governor. He's saying that these cuts are going to lead to a shutdown in drug courts, possibly a shutdown in pretrial services. So really, like, something that would end up affecting a whole lot of, the entire court system across the state. And he was saying that if Bevin's proposal to have 4.5% cuts this year, the court system would have to shut down for 3 weeks, is his claim.
Yeah, and that he made that, he put that position out there, what's it been, weeks ago. I'm just wondering, is it real or is it a bargaining chip, Ryland? I mean, is he just trying to, How serious is it?
It's a great question. I mean, that's a great question. I mean, the budgeting process is, very. There is a lot of asking for a whole lot and expecting to get a bit less than that. So I mean, it's hard to say. It's hard to say what would happen. Now, the interesting wrinkle with the judicial branch is that the Chief Justice Minton is saying that the cuts would actually lead to the court system not being able to fulfill its constitutional duties, for speedy trial, to provide, bail hearings for people in a timely manner. So people would just effectively be sitting around in jails, and effectively, a lot of this money is coming from counties in Kentucky. He's kind of painted a very, dire situation.
A very bleak picture, yes.
Of course, it's not unusual in any budget negotiations for hyperbole and exaggeration, too. So I don't know. It remains to be seen whether this would, you know, actually happen. But
every time I talk to you, Ryan, though, I get the sense that this is a pretty serious one.
It certainly seems to be that way.
513-419-7100 if you would like to join us. And Ryland, one of the issues that's come up in the General Assembly and budgeting for education is the idea of performance funding. Can you tell us about that? Explain what that is.
So that was a proposal that Governor Bevin made, and he didn't really have too much of a plan for it. The Democratic-led House didn't really include that at all in their proposal. They actually, in their proposal, added about $215 million back into higher education, which is, you know, that is very popular with some people. And then once the bill ended up getting to the Senate, they restored those cuts. The cuts are back in, and they brought back in the governor's proposal for performance funding. Now, what they want to do is basically it's about $204 million in the budget that that the universities would compete over, well, universities and community colleges. They're proposing to separate the schools into three different tiers. So at the top, you got the big research institutions, U of L and UK, and then the second tier are the regional universities like Eastern Kentucky, Western Kentucky, and Murray State. And then at the bottom tier, the third tier, rather, is the community college system, and they would be competing against one another for 25% of the entire system's funding. So whichever schools do the best, would end up getting more funding than the ones that that fall behind them. It's kind of a complicated system. It's almost like developing a whole new sport or something. But the governor, for example, would be able to, with his discretion, restore some of that funding to universities if he felt that it would be too stark of a cut for their budgets. We'll see how it's received. It sounds like Democrats leading the House aren't too big a fans of it, but it's been thrown around that a possible compromise would be, okay, we'll let you have performance funding if you let us restore the $215 million in proposed cuts.
And that's an interesting analogy, Ryland, a whole new sport. Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to talk to us. And Scott, how are the House and Senate dealing with a GOP governor? I mean, has this changed the dynamic in this whole process?
Well, it seems like, and Ryland, I don't know if you can back me up on this or not, being down there, but the Democrats have some breathing room after having won three out of the four open seats that were up for grabs in early March. But I don't think the governor did himself any favors when he had that snarky YouTube video of going into an empty chamber, and the House didn't convene. They don't normally convene till 4 on Mondays, and he just happened to go in there at 11 and act like, hey, they're not working. And they were over in the other building, the annex, actually putting together the budget. So that definitely didn't do him any favors in having a working relationship with the House.
Yeah, you're definitely right that those the special elections, there were special elections for four vacant House seats a few weeks ago. And Democrats ended up winning three out of four of those special elections. So a little bit of background, Democrats have a very narrow majority in the House. At the time of those special elections, they had 50 members and Republicans had 46. So Republicans were looking to tie if they got those four seats. Democrats ended up winning it, so they actually buffered their majority by a bit. Now they're leading, 53-47. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they have some padding. There was definitely some hand-wringing going on about Republicans taking over the state House. The House is the last legislative chamber in the entire South that's controlled by Democrats. So it's been put in the sights of both state Democrats here and by state Republicans here and by Republicans as a whole. And so, yeah, it's a very interesting situation. It's just this kind of new political reality that we haven't seen in a while in Kentucky.
Ryland, I don't know if you've been able to get a sense, because Bevin still, at least for me, seems to be kind of an unknown as far as how much he's willing to compromise and what his negotiation style will be like. He didn't seem very diplomatic with that YouTube video. Have you been able to get an idea whether he's going to be hardline on negotiating this budget out?
It's a bit of a wild card, but as you say, he has reiterated several times that he will not sign a budget that there are several things that has any kind of includes any kind of form of bonding for the pension system that doesn't include the cuts to state spending as he would like to see it. I do imagine once the bill hits his desk, and especially things coming so down to the wire that. There's going to be considerable pressure to compromise. And the other thing is that both versions of the budget don't really differ all that much. There's a couple big things. There's that education factor that I was talking about. So, House Democrats want to add in $215 million back into the budget. So that's something to consider. There's that performance funding part of it. That's something to consider. And then the other big thing is how each deals with the pension system. Again, that's what Bevin's whole philosophy of this budget has been. The cuts are for the pension system. He wants to set aside, he wants to create this new fund for the state called a permanent fund, where he would take essentially extra money in state coffers and set it aside for future pension payments because this is something on down the road that would be added to the system if things were going wrong or say the state did have extra money and could had a little bit of extra they could take here and put there instead of what normally happens just putting that money into some other state service in the budget. So that's definitely something that's got to be resolved, and I think that's probably one of the big sticking points that he's gonna want. He's gonna want that permanent fund, and he's gonna want some semblance of a whole bunch of money going into the pension systems.
We will continue our conversation about the Kentucky General Assembly. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining me this afternoon, Cincinnati and Kentucky Inquirer River City's reporter Scott Wortman and Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Scott, just how dangerous is this whole thing of getting the pensions funded to the right level? I mean, could all this implode at some point and you find teachers and state employees losing their pensions as they near retirement? I mean, that just doesn't sound like that's
what the governor says is at stake. But I think for most of the listeners here, it does have a real drain on what the government can provide in terms of infrastructure, in terms of roads, in terms of everything, and higher education. So it's one of those wonky things that's kind of hard to break down, but it affects pretty much everything.
Mm-hmm. What does this budget mean for Northern Kentucky? What's at stake for that part of the state?
Well, heroin funding is one of the bigger issues that a lot of the local lawmakers are. By heroin funding, I mean heroin treatment funding. The governor's budget has $30 million for that. The House budget took out $12 million, but the Senate restored that. And one of the Children's Home in Northern Kentucky in Transitions, the Children's Home which treats youth behavioral and substance abuse problems, and they're going for $5.6 million, and Transitions is going for $1 million, and that would basically allow them to have more treatment beds. So that's one of the big issues in Northern Kentucky, because Northern Kentucky has one of the highest rates of heroin abuse and overdoses. It's a national problem, but Northern Kentucky particularly is hit because of I-75 and 471. You have a lot of dealers and people that are use that highway. That's one big issue. Speaking of 75, the Brent Spence Bridge is also another issue.
The never-ending issue?
Yes, which I don't think will end probably in our lifetimes. I don't
know. Oh,
yeah. It's going to be a few more decades or lifetimes before that, I think, gets addressed. It's the governor and both budgets have $38 million in the budget for cosmetic repairs, repainting, try and come up with a way to handle the traffic flow. But the big question is how to pay for the $2.6 billion replacement, which is needed at least in 20 or 30 years. The bridge won't fall down, they at least say won't fall down in the next
decade. Right, they say it's,
decades.
What is it, functionally obsolete, I think is the term they use. It's not structurally obsolete.
Yes.
It's functionally obsolete. I'm chuckling in the background.
I think the big issue is, though, outside of Northern Kentucky, other lawmakers, they don't care about it. It's not their project. So if there's a lot of opposition to financing the bridge through any other means like tolls, they're content to just let it languish.
Ryland, what's your take on the whole Brent Spence Bridge thing? Ever get done at any point in history?
Well, I don't know as far about about timeline and stuff if it's ever going to get done. I definitely agree that the tolling the Brent Spence Bridge is it seems to be very unpopular in the legislature, especially among the Northern Kentucky lawmakers that I've heard from. There's this kind of perennial bill that was sometimes proposed to fix the bridge, which is the public-private partnership bill, which essentially would allow a private company to front a bunch of the money for the project and then and work with the state on it, and then they would be allowed to, through user fees or tolls, make money back on the project over a period of decades or something like that. Now, the P3 bill has actually passed both chambers now, passed the House and the Senate, but, of course, it has an amendment that keeps – I don't even know if it's an amendment. It might just be in the bill itself. Mm-hmm. That it's any I can't remember what it's called – any, like, infrastructure connecting Ohio and Kentucky is not allowed to use the P3 formula. So Brent Spence Bridge will not be helped or addressed by the P3 bill.
Yeah, that bill kept on getting killed because of opposition to tolls on the Brent Spence. So the sponsor of that bill this year, I believe Leslie Combs, she said, "I don't even want to hear that bridge's name mentioned."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, no. And so, interestingly, I mean, this bill passed both chambers, 2 years ago, and Governor Beshear actually vetoed it because it didn't include, similarly prevented P3s from being used on the Brent Spence Bridge. He vetoed it because he, essentially wanted that to be an option.
And give me the quick definition for P3.
Public-private partnerships. Basically, it allows private funds, such as like tolls, to be used for public projects.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And Buddy in Covington joins us now. Hi, Buddy.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
I'm sorry. I am recently joining this conversation, so I may have missed this earlier. The question I have is regarding the Kentucky Senate's forecasting methodology. The governor used one conservative forecasting methodology. The House used a less conservative, and there's a standard. I don't know what they're called, but do we know what the Senate used when they came up with their budget?
My understanding is that the Senate returned back to the governor's, essentially a pessimistic estimate of how much money the state is going to make over the 2 years. The rationale for that, the governor's rationale and the Senate's rationale, has been, we'll budget for pessimistic, and hey, if things turn out normal or better than that, then we'll have all this extra money, which, again, the governor wants to put into a reserved pension fund. A special fund for the pension.
Well, that's fine too, and I think this is what I've heard Speaker Stumbo say about that fund. It's not been set up by statute, so there's no requirement or guideline or anything for the governor to do whatever he was claiming that's going to be done with it. And I guess that leads to this question about, there's probably still not time to create any statute for this extra reserve that goes that I guess the governor wants and the Senate put back in the budget bill. There wouldn't be time for that, would there?
That's been a big point of opposition on the House's part. I mean, I think that there's still, you know, there's still time. There's days left in the legislative session, but it would be difficult at this point just with all the other things going on. And the other thing, too, is that, you know, even if you by, you know, in statute, if you pass a bill that that creates this permanent fund for pensions, you know, what prevents a future legislature from coming in and changing the law again for that. So that's part of the critique, and really, and most of it right now is just that there isn't even such a law proposed right now. It's just that the governor wants to set aside something, and some people are scared that, you know, that'll just essentially let him do whatever he wants with that money, because there aren't these restrictions as you're pointing out.
Let's move on another topic here. Scott, Kentucky had its first GOP caucus ever.
Yes.
Right? Now, that was because of Rand Paul, correct?
Correct.
In the whole situation, I'm in the Senate, but I'm running for the president.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Then, of course, by the time the Kentucky GOP caucus gets here, Rand Paul is not in the presidential race anymore. What are the lessons that came out of that, the whole caucus situation?
Well, I think that we won't probably see another one until there's another Republican senator in Kentucky that wants to run for president. It was one of the more, probably the most awkward election I'd covered, because the reason for having it ceased to be a month before the election, before the caucus. It was, if they do have another one, Northern Kentucky in particular, they only had one location per county, and turned out to be a mess with an hour and a half, 2 hour waits in some places. So it's something I don't think we'll see again for a while.
Well, is there any fallout from having this GOP caucus?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know if it's necessarily just the GOP caucus, but also with the just contentious primary in the Republican Party. You have a friction between the Tea Party and the establishment Republicans in Northern Kentucky right now as they pick their delegates. Just in the past week, the executive committees in Kenton and Campbell counties, for the first time in any memory, the slate for delegates that was picked by the leadership got voted down. And a lot of Tea Party people now will be going to the district convention, which goes to the state convention. And there's talk of some of the operatives from Cruz, Kasich, trying to sway some delegate votes if they don't vote for Trump in the first ballot. Trump won Kentucky in the caucus.
Hey, Ryland, how did the things go in your part of the state with the caucuses? Long lines there as well, I take it, or?
I mean, there were sporadically long lines. The places I was paying attention to were Lexington, and then Bowling Green, and then way out in western Kentucky as well. I mean, really the main complaints that I heard were people living in rural areas, you know, ending up having to travel long distances into a centralized caucus location. You know, there was only one caucus per county, with actually, except some of the bigger counties had several caucus locations. And I think that really the thing that the Republican Party is trying to decide or will be evaluating over the next 4 years is whether, you know, all of the hiccups and stuff are, A, is it something that they can fix, and B, is it worth it for Kentucky to have this kind of earlier primary, somehow be involved in the conversation, in the nominating process? Because, you know, Kentucky got, Donald Trump, we got Ben Carson visited, actually, but he stepped out of the race just before the caucus. So it was some attention. For that one Saturday, everybody was paying attention to Kentucky along with the whatever else it was, Louisiana and Maine. They liked that. And I think they'll be evaluating that over the next 4 years.
Are you with Scott? Do you think they have another one?
I think that they would have another one. I think that they're happy with
the way it went in general.
The turnout.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Scott and Ryland, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Cincinnati and Kentucky Inquirer River City's reporter Scott Wortman and Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Ryland Barton.